Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Barry Hertz, who is the author of the new book about the Fast and Furious movie series, Welcome to the Family, the explosive story behind Fast and Furious, the blockbusters that supercharged the world. I've got my preview copy here. I've read the whole thing. Barry, thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, my gosh, Sonny. Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
So it's funny, you reached out to me and you're like, Sonny, I know you're not a fan of the Fast and Furious movies. I know that's not your, this is not your ideal series, but I think you'll enjoy this book. And I have to say you were 100% right. I am not a fan of the Fast and Furious series, but I do think that this is it's a really entertaining book just as a kind of history of a moment in Hollywood and a collection of really interesting people and kind of how things have changed in and around the industry, because this is a story about economics as much as anything else. Barry, when Rob Cohen sits down to make the first of these movies back in the early 2000s, what does the landscape of the cinematic universe look like?
I mean, cinematic universes are non-existent back then, right? I mean, we have like sequels, you got a couple of American Pies, you got a couple of Mummy movies, but there's no interconnected storytelling. That's just not something that's going on. It's one and done. And so when Rob Cohen sits down to make this, Universal just considers it what they call a programmer, just like a tidy, mid-budget movie to get audiences in on spring break. There's no franchise ambitions. And when people were coming in to pitch movies at that time, you weren't pitching part two, part three, spinoff, solo television adventure, maybe. You were getting way ahead of the game. Nobody was thinking about those kind of brand extensions back then. It was a one and done kind of business.
And so this movie comes in and it costs about $30 million to make.
Yeah, like 36, 38.
Nobody is expecting a ton from it. And then it blows up. How did this movie find its audience and what was the reaction to it? Because I was in college when this movie came out and the response to it. I remember the dorm room rewatches and everything. what was the response to this movie?
I mean, on the ground, I can say like I was a teenager working at a suburban Toronto multiplex when this movie came out. And I remember the opening weekend and after the first showing in the parking lot, these, kids with very crappy cars were trying to do whatever they could possibly to make those cars sound exciting because they were just revved up. Like they were trying to pull off whatever donuts or whatever they could do in the parking lot with their mom's little Acura or something like that. There was an immediate thrill that was happening there. And the box office that opening weekend, it blew past everybody's expectations. It made its production budget back and then some just on opening weekend. People were kind of just a little hungry for something that had even the hint of authenticity and spoke to youth audiences in a different way than was currently being done through the major Hollywood studios. But then, the movie finds its real success in the DVD market. I mean, that was, nascent at the time. And it was found money for Hollywood. They didn't have to put anything really into it except the production costs. And they got way more of that money back than they were with a theatrical release when they were splitting the revenue with this, with the exhibitors. So this was, you know, a huge windfall for Universal at the time. And then, as you see, like, if this movie was on cable forever, if you were flipping past a television station and landed on TBS or TNT, there was a probably like 25 to 35% chance you would land on The Fast and the Furious at some point around 2002, 2003. And so it just bred familiarity. And these were, again, it was just like couch. It was more than couch cushion money, but it was just the akin to like looking under it and finding it there. It was free. It was easy. And that led to a whole franchise and eventually cinematic universe worth exploiting.
Yeah, I want to drill down on the DVD thing here, because I do think I don't think folks outside of the industry understand just how lucrative this market, the home video market, had become at this point. So when, you know, we talk about a movie making, making its budget back in theaters and then, you know, coming home, what were the stats like on this number or on this movie, like compared to other films at the time? What was Fast and Furious doing on DVD compared to some of the other, you know, even big movies that were out at the time?
I mean, this was selling tens of millions of single copy DVDs first week of release. It was getting into people's homes in an unprecedented way and very quickly became Universal's biggest selling DVD of all time. And again, like, this was just when, if you didn't see a movie when it had its theatrical run, you were waiting quite a while until it hit the rental market, until it hit the cable television market, until it hit the broadcast television market. So if you wanted to get that first rush of either something you missed in the theaters or something you had really a lot of fun with at the theaters, then you went to Best Buy. You went to wherever your local DVD shop was and you actually bought a copy for $20. It was, you know, it was not a huge investment at the time, and it was really the only way you were going to get that real first exposure post-theatrical. One really caught on. It's kind of crazy to look back at.
Yeah. No, the DVD market, again, the DVD, the boom, that initial DVD boom was a really interesting time to be a movie fan, because there was this it was such a weird confluence of events, because you had studios that, you know, as you say, had this kind of found money sensibility with these things, like, oh, we can sell these DVDs to everyone and they will buy them, and they're like cheap, they're, you know, it's two times the cost of a ticket, but we're not losing out on the theatrical revenue. It's just, as you say, found money. But then you also had Best Buy and Circuit City and Walmart. Rest of these companies all competing with each other with turning the DVDs into loss leaders to get you in the door. So it was like, it was not, I rarely spent $20 on a DVD. I was spending like 12 13. Like it was just this crazy time.
Yeah. I mean, I have like super fond memories of, like a 2 for $22 kind of sale at Future Shop, which is kind of the big Best Buy equivalent up in Canada, or was. It doesn't exist anymore for obvious reasons. But I mean, and you can kind of glimpse behind my shelves here, like so much of my high school income that I made at that movie theater went back straight to the DVD market. And oftentimes it wasn't, you know, I didn't have, studios would toss like a bonus feature here or there, something like that. And sometimes there was a lot of effort put into it, sometimes not. More so now, if you get some kind of home release, it's because a place like Criterion or Vinegar Syndrome or some specialty outfit like Arrow like put actual resources into it, because it's a specialty product. But back then, it was a mass market product. You just wanted the movie.
Yeah. It is the way the market has shifted from kind of a mass market to a more of a niche collector's thing has been interesting to watch. A friend of mine, Peter Suderman, texted me today. It was like, did you know that Eddington is only available on 4K from the A24 website? And I pulled out my copy of Eddington that I had bought from the A24 website. I was like, yes, Peter, I do know that. I do see, I have it right here. Yeah. Because it is interesting to, and this is the first really, this is the first of the big shifts, the first of the big economic shifts that the Fast and the Furious is kind of riding the wave of driving down the highway of the Hollywood economic highway. Mm-hmm. The second, of course, is the internationalization of box office. And I want to get to that. We'll get to that in a second with Tokyo Drift. But before that, we have to get into the real fascinating kind of undercurrent of this whole story, which is the Vin Diesel of it all. Right. Because the Vin Diesel is notably conspicuously absent from Fast and Furious 2. Too Fast, Too Furious. I'm sorry, Too Fast, Too Furious. I get that right.
We got to get the titles right.
What happened? What was going on with Vin Diesel at this? Why wasn't he in the movie?
I mean, so when the first Fast was developed, it was developed as a star vehicle for Paul Walker. Vin was not there from the ground up. This was Paul Walker coming off the Skulls with Rob Cohen, the director, and Neil H. Moritz, the producer, and Universal, the studio. And they wanted to all work together, and they saw something special in Paul. And Paul, being Paul and kind of that laid-back Southern California guy, was like, yeah, man, I really want to play a cop. I could flash a gun, drive a car, get a girl. And they kind of crafted this around him. But then they needed the antagonist. They needed the yin to the yang kind of thing. And then they found Vin Diesel as the Dom Toretto. But after the movie opened, you know, when Vin walks onto the screen that first time, I mean, there is an immediate jolt. You realize this guy has star potential. And the movie was so successful that, you know, not incorrectly, he assumed he was the biggest name in Hollywood overnight, almost. I mean, he was a character actor before. He had small supporting roles. He was in Saving Private Ryan. He did have Pitch Black not too long before. But that was, again, kind of a tiny effort that succeeded almost despite its genre trappings. But the studio was like, obviously, we're going to make another one of these. Obviously, we need these two guys to return. And then Vin was like, oh, obviously, you need to pay me $10 million, which was about 10 times the amount of money that he got for the first one. So contract negotiations were very tough. You know, he was playing it in the press as, I don't want to sully the reputation of this movie from becoming a classic by sequelizing it, you know, taking a great stance against sequels, which we'll see he didn't really hold on to for any part of his career afterward. And he walked away and he went to go do XXX with Rob Cohen instead. And something that put him front and center. He didn't have to share the spotlight with any kind of star. And his character's name was the character of the movie. It was right there. But Universal still very much wanted to do Fast, and they still knew they had to move quickly to, you know, retain the heat of the first movie's momentum. They had Paul contractually obliged to do a sequel, and they went forth and subbed him out with another rising new star named Tyrese.
And of course, the one of the joys of the series is that once you get introduced in a Fast and Furious movie, you never leave the series.
You're
there forever.
You're family for life. Yeah, I mean, family is forever, right? Is it not? So,
So Tyrese is in them for the long haul, even though he is kind of subbed in. All right, so Too Fast, Too Furious comes out, and it's a slight disappointment in the sense that, you know, box office is down. It doesn't have the same draw as the first, but again, the DVD sales are through the roof.
The DVD sales are through the roof. It's enormous. Yeah. Huge.
Enormous hit.
Yeah.
And then the third movie comes out, and this is Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift, which was for a long time considered to be kind of, you know, the least successful of the series. It is probably, mm-hmm. I think it's technically box office terms is the least successful of the series.
However, it is almost
inarguably the most important of the series for two key reasons. The first is, as I mentioned, the internationalization of the box office.
Right.
And I want to talk to you about that, but also the introduction of Justin Lin sitting in the director's chair. What energy does Justin Lin bring to this series?
I mean, Justin Lin just revitalizes it, and it was not like such a moribund thing that it was dying or had been through so many iterations that it was feeling stale. And yet he brought this from the ground, cultural diversity, authenticity, excitement, hardcore action that was all in camera, very practical. And he brought this storytelling method, which was spoke to a young audience. Like, he was a member of that generation. Like, he grew up watching the first Fast movie, you know, in his early days in university. And he decided, like, to just, you know, put the whole of himself and what he thought audiences of his generation would want to see in this. And he was very much a huge proponent of authenticity and Asian culture. So when this movie kind of came into his lap, he had just come off of directing Annapolis for Paramount, his big first studio movie. But more importantly, he had made Better Luck Tomorrow. So this was a huge kind of Sundance hit about a bunch of Asian American students in Southern California who kind of turned to a life of crime to enliven their lives and the academic pressures that they feel. And it was such a successful look at a group of people and, you know, looking at a community that don't see themselves represented on screen very often, that it felt fresh and it felt new and it generated a lot of controversy at the time. But it also showed that he was a good stylist as well. So all those elements combined bring him to Tokyo Drift. He gets a script. It's kind of loaded with, you know, Asian cliches, white man in a strange land, geishas, kimonos. And he's like, no. Tokyo is like actually kind of like a postmodern city. Like, we got to be modern with this. We got to be contemporary and we got to be authentic. I want Japanese actors speaking, not like trying to speak broken English. We need subtitles. We need to get, you know, actual Japanese talent in there. We need to film there. And that's what he does. And it didn't do as well as the box office as the first two, but it found a big life again on DVD and it started making huge roads internationally in the theatrical market. It was, I think, the first Fast movie to make more globally than it did domestically.
Yeah, and so this is the second kind of big economic wave that the series rides, which is the boom of overseas box offices. You know, before this, it was usually, at the risk of, somebody was going to yell at me in the comments, but at the risk of overgeneralizing, you know, you would look at getting about 2/3 of your box office in the United States and Canada, mm-hmm. and about 1/3 overseas, sometimes closer to half, split it halfways each way. But this movie is the first to flip that, to invert that. I think it was 60-40 overseas versus domestic. And it would only grow after that. But that's a trend reflected throughout the industry. At this time. I mean, this is a thing that Tokyo Drift is very much a harbinger of, but by no means the biggest example.
No, not at all. I mean, yeah, this, so as you say, like back then, you know, global box office outside of US and Canada, it was like the icing on the cake. It was nice to have, you know, you could get, you know, kind of top it off a little bit, but it wasn't something that was driving the production of any of these movies. But very quickly, studios were making these movies explicitly to appeal to those foreign territories. I mean, we see China becoming a huge player in the 2010s. Marvel appealing directly to their tastes, putting in product placement. The Transformers movies are especially guilty of this. And also kind of kowtowing to Chinese censors to get through the Beijing board of officials and make the certain amount of Hollywood films that were allowed to play in China at the time. And Fast was very conscious of this as well.
Yeah. In the book, you talk to Chris Fenton, who right. has been on this show before. I've talked to Chris before. Enjoy talking mm-hmm. to Chris. But he kind of shepherded a lot of those early Chinese Hollywood partnerships, including Looper and Iron Man 3, which, you know, I think did set the stage for a lot of what would follow.
Completely, yeah. But the interesting things about the Fast films is that they've been very successful in China, even as the Chinese marketplace has changed and evolved and kind of grown out of its Hollywood taste. But at the same time, the Fast films have never really played to the Chinese audience in an explicit way. Like, they have mm-hmm. not been, there's not a single film that's been set in China. There was one scene in, I think, number 6, where it's set in Hong Kong for like a second, but it's not actually filmed there. They've never, you know, inserted some Chinese megastars like Fan Bingbing into the margins there just to get a little recognition from the audience there. There's no product placement. There's not even a, you know, Chinese-made automobile that pops up in any of these movies. And yet, the films have so appealed to that marketplace that it's become a huge part of their, you know, production budget calculus.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's interesting because these this series of films is organically diverse in a way that is hard to replicate in these sorts of movies. It's not, you know, it appeals to multiple regions. We can get into this in movies 4 and 5, but there's a huge South and Central American audience that comes with those films. There is the Asian audience, of course, with Tokyo Drift and elsewhere. It's again, this is another element of the changing business, capturing that market, but without ever really pandering. I think somebody in you quote somebody in your book who calls this like the most woke series of all time, which is like kind of an interesting way to put it, but I don't think that's actually right. I think it's naturally diverse in a way that doesn't rub anybody the wrong way, and that's an almost impossible thing to do. It's really interesting.
It's very interesting, and it's because the roots of it were organic. I feel like when they made that first movie, it was Rob Cohen and it was screenwriter David Ayer mostly who were trying to be authentic to the Southern California car culture that they saw at the time, which was a lot of, you know, black drivers and Vietnamese drivers and Hispanic drivers. And they just really wanted to represent that in the casting. And that's why you see, you know, the very ethnically ambiguous Vin Diesel in that lead role, and why you see Michelle Rodriguez in there, and why you see, like, you know, real car people like RJ De Vera playing some of the street racers. So it kind of grew out of that. And then, you know, you go to number two where it's Miami, John Singleton's there, and he's trying to do a very kind of specific thing with black culture in Miami. And he's staying away from South Beach. He's going to the more historically black neighborhoods like Overton. And then you bring in Justin Lin and get that Asian, you know, that very specific, genuine Asian American representation. So it was kind of put together in this natural way. It wasn't, you know, studio mandated. You got to have like a person of X color here and X color there. This was happening before the whole Oscars so white controversy. This was happening before diversity was a watchword and a mandate in the studio environment. And as you say, like once you're in these films, they're very much intent on bringing you back in some form. So by the time we get to 5, you know, we're bringing back Tyrese from and Ludacris from number 2. We're bringing back Gal Gadot from number 4. We're bringing back Sun Kang from number 3. And that's just the way it's been. And then they continue on that path. And it is diversity. It is representation. But it's never screaming in your face about that. It's not even whispering it to you. If you are a member of this crew of car thieves and street racers and turn like, you know, superpowered super spies, it's not because of the color of your skin or anything like that. It's just like, how big is your engine? Can you drive this car? All right, you're it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then of course we get to the series circa 4, but particularly 5 and on, where it explodes into a sort of a cinematic universe of sorts, though it's really still just mostly sequels. But then you have spinoffs with Hobbs and Shaw. You've got The Rock coming in. You got Jason Statham. You got all these guys coming in there. And that is the ultimate goal of every studio now, is to have a series like this that is self-perpetuating and mm-hmm. everything is linked into everything else. But it was really tricky for them to do, because they had to essentially rejigger the whole timeline on the fly without over explaining it to people.
Yeah. I mean, the whole timeline thing about, you know, keeping Han alive for as long as they possibly could, the Sun Kang character, by like rewiring the order of the film. So it's actually technically 1, 2, 4, 5, 6. 3, 7, 8, 9, 10. It's like this total nerd retcon thing that I personally love and can't get enough of. But like, when they tried explaining this to the audience, to the studios, what they were doing, they're like, will anybody understand this, or will anybody care? They're like, yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, they'll understand it or they won't. They'll just enjoy it. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of the dream franchise in that way. And you're right, it is self-perpetuating. You just keep on adding bigger, balder men to the series, and you get, you know, all of these ideas, natural ideas for spinoffs, and, you know, some television series have been mulled over the years, and I'm sure it will only be a matter of time before that happens. But the other thing is, like, it's not based on anything other than like this long forgotten Vibe magazine article. There's no fidelity to a comic book that they have to adhere to. There's no literary source material for the Fast and Furious that they kind of need to keep in mind when, you know, figuring out the chronology or the canon or the expansion of this universe. It can kind of be whatever you want or need it to be, so long as you have a few key elements, like, you know, fast cars.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit about some of the drama at the heart of this thing, because this is, again, it's a really compelling book to read, at least in part because there are so many competing people and ideas, and also, I mean, like, some genuine heartbreak. The Paul Walker, of course, dies during the filming of Fast 7, which creates a whole issue there with, in terms of like, what are they going to do? Do they want to keep going? When you were talking to people, when you were interviewing, and you interviewed 200 some people for this book, you talked to tons and tons of people. When you were talking to people, what were the kind of constant through lines? What were some of the threads that were picked up over and over again of like, well, this has been a problem, or this has been great, or what?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the constant through lines, and this won't surprise too many people who've been paying attention to the series or to Hollywood, you know, over the past two decades, is like, Vin Diesel, kind of like a complicated guy. He's a little, you know, he's a little difficult to work with. You know, at one point he's like this force of sheer self-determination and will. Like, he just wants to do something and he will it into existence. Like, he is kind of, you know, certainly since coming back into the franchise for that cameo in 3 and then gaining producer powers for number 4 and onwards, like, what he wants this series to be, he has made happen. And that is very impressive. At the same time, according to a lot of people that I spoke with, not the easiest guy to work with, consistently late, like, to the point of causing massive production delays and wasting untold amounts of money. Very micromanaging in terms of the script, to the point of driving away Justin Lin on the 10th film, just a few days into production, which is kind of like an unprecedented thing. And just really bending it toward, you know, the arc of the Fast movies is the arc of the career of Vin Diesel. So that's been certainly a through line. And a lot of people who have worked on these films have not been happy with him. At the same time, you have the other side of the Fast equation, which is Paul. And whether this is because he gets the halo of being, you know, not with us anymore, but people just loved him. They found him to be so genuine, so honest, an actual car person, very enthusiastic and committed to car culture, and just like a great guy to be around, like, was always ready to go, you know, was very easygoing, would ask you about your family, would actually try to make genuine connections in these massive, huge Hollywood machines. And so you have those competing, two sides of the movie business. The actual guy who wants to get it done and respects it and loves the work and loves, you know, just entertaining and storytelling. And then, you know, the unstoppable, immovable force of Vin Diesel. And because they were paired together on screen for so long, it creates this really interesting tension that, you know, is laced through the entire franchise up until, you know, Paul's awful, tragic death in the midst of filming the seventh film.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I remember the day that happened. It was crazy. That was one of the craziest stories from the last 10 years of Hollywood.
Completely. I mean, it was Thanksgiving weekend of 2012, I believe. And I remember seeing the news flash on my phone, on my computer. I don't know, but I was taken aback. I was a huge fan of the series, obviously, back then. And it really like knocked me down. And the circumstances around it are just so incredibly awful and deeply, darkly ironic that you had a hard time accepting that it wasn't some hoax that was floating around.
Yeah. Let's and then I, you know, the Vin Diesel question is you know, kind of interesting, because he the most famous feud from the series is him and Dwayne Johnson. Of course, there's a lot of you know, those two butting heads, because Dwayne Johnson does not like to have his time wasted. And Vin Diesel does not care about Dwayne Johnson's time. It was that caused a lot of headaches, right?
Yeah. I mean, you had like these two alphas going up against each other. And that was, you know, that was a big part of the appeal of bringing Dwayne Johnson into Fast Five. Like, he beefed it up, like, in all senses of that word. He leveled it up. And it was very much like, you know, Justin Lin's kind of wish fulfillment as a kid of the 80s, like putting Schwarzenegger and Stallone against each other back then. I mean, and you can kind of draw a lot of parallels. Like, I feel like Vin is such a Stallone kind of guy, like this tortured poet who's kind of like been pushed into this muscle-bound territory. And Schwarzenegger is just like that, you know, always smiling, charming, cocksure crowd pleaser in the Johnson mold. And you just bring the two of them together, naturally you're going to have some kind of conflict. But it did not help that, yeah, Dwayne Johnson valued his time to the second. And Vin Diesel, the concept of time doesn't seem to exist outside of whatever is in his own personal purview. So you get that. You get The Rock's career on ascendance as the Fast franchise goes forward. You know, he develops a number of other franchises for himself, Jumanji, whatever. And Vin is kind of, you know, he's got the Riddick and he's got the XXX, and he's, you know, he says his three words of dialogue for the Guardians of the Galaxy series. But he's not on the Rock level anymore. So he has to kind of watch and stew as this guy who, in his mind, he brought over and made this big star. Like, you know, he was not the star he was before Fast Five. He was, you know, he was struggling. He had some weird projects going on between that, like, do I want to be an action star? Do I want to be like this family friendly comedy guy and like the Disney mold? Mm. And so Vin feels like, you know, I made this guy's bones. Now he's up on top of me. And now he's like making fun of me on his Ballers show on HBO. And, you know, I'm going to piss this guy off a little bit more than everybody else.
Yeah. One of the really great things about your book is that you seem to have talked to a lot of the stunt drivers, a lot of the stunt, mm-hmm. the guy, I will not be able to pronounce his name.
Spiro Rosatos.
Rosatos. Okay. Great. Yeah. Great. I was close.
You're close, yeah.
But like those guys are doing it for real in those cars. I mean, particularly up through, you know, the seventh or so entry, all of that stuff more or less is practical. It gets a little more CGI as you go. What were their recollections of these projects like?
I mean, these are the guys who, like, I learned so much about stunts and second unit and like third unit and all the splinter units on working on this book. And, you know, I've always been a big action movie guy, so I've always appreciated the work that went into the stunts, but these guys are truly giving their bodies to the cinema. Like, these guys are putting their lives on the line every day. And they do it because they love it. Like, they love that these guys are thrill seekers. A lot of them are, like, truly crazy people with a love of movies, but they're just doing things that no man should ever do to themselves or to a car. But they're doing it because they love it. But they do feel constantly disrespected, constantly under-acknowledged. They're not paid nearly as much as they should be. They've been fighting for recognition from the Academy Awards forever, which finally looks like it's about to happen in 2027, 2028. But, you know, they're off to the side and they're not interacting with the stars. You know, Second Unit is a totally different thing. That's so Spiro Rosados has been the Second Unit director of the Fast film since Part 5. He made his bones in like the direct to DVD or really direct to like HBO early days of like these really cheap, you know, like Eric Estrada kind of action movies. But he was just going full throttle because he didn't have a safety net, because he didn't have money. So he knew how to make crazy action happen on a budget. And that's what Justin Lin kind of saw in him and brought him over. And they've been doing insane things ever since. But yeah, they do feel very undervalued. And the other thing is with these movies, you know, it's like this, I'm sure, on a lot of big, huge blockbusters, but on the Fast movies especially, the script is such a fluid thing. Nothing is set in stone. And once you change one thing, it has a domino effect on a million different other things. So, you know, I was talking to stunt drivers who were on Part 7, and they're sitting on the set. Like, they're up in, like, Pikes Peak, you know, in Colorado there, waiting to get in a car. But the car hasn't even been built yet or, you know, stylized or checked for safety because the script keeps on changing. And all the different requirements for that set piece keep changing. So they're you know, either left twiddling their thumbs or they're suddenly thrust into a life or death situation with, you know, relatively little notice.
Yeah. And, like, amazingly, nobody has died on one of these movies, I don't think, right?
No,
there were a couple injuries, but a
couple,
you know,
close
not,
calls.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a bad head injury on 9, which a subsidiary of Universal had to fork over damages to in the UK. But no, considering like the amount of crazy things that they have done and so much of it practical, the safety record speaks for itself.
Yeah. There's one line in your book where one of the stunt guys, maybe it's Rosados, is talking about, you know, we on some shows I'm on, you know, they make us we do everything by the book and we don't damage the cameras. On a Fast and Furious movie, we're busting 9 or 10 up a show.
Like, oh, yeah. Spiro, like the great thing about Spiro was he would constantly put the camera equipment in mortal danger. Like, he was destroying cameras on the regular, like just causing insane amounts of cost overruns. But that's because it was all to get that shot. And like, if you watch Fast 5 again, which I feel like even a non-Fast and Furious enthusiast would find some interesting things in there, including the vault chase at the end of the movie. Like, you know, there's so many moments where you get footage up until the moment of impact when a piece of debris slams against the camera and knocks that camera out of commission.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. What did we not discuss about the Fast and Furious, the series or your book, or, you know, what should folks know that we did not talk about today?
I guess the only other thing to kind of touch upon is like the future of Fast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because so, you know, the last installment that audiences have seen was Fast X, and this back in the summer of 2023. And it ended on a huge cliffhanger, like a literal cliffhanger in which the characters are awaiting their fates while standing on the edge of a cliff. And the most to be continued of any of those movies has ever been. And when it premiered, you know, Vin Diesel was on the red carpet in Rome saying like, all right, the original plan was, you know, one more, but actually we're going to go two more for this final trilogy. And then it's been radio silence ever since. So, you know, a lot, and some of this has been out there already. There's a Wall Street Journal article about a month ago. And I have also been made to understand this, is that the last one, Fast X, cost a genuinely concerning amount of money. Some reports peg it as like $450 million, which would make it one of the highest cost movies ever made. And it did not make that back commensurately enough with what would need to justify another one at that scale. So word in Universal is they need to downsize the budget incredibly, like shave at least like $100 million plus off of that to make it a reality. And the other part that's a little bit more underreported is that Vin Diesel has some own personal and legal troubles that he needs to settle. He's been sued for sexual battery by a former assistant. This was going to go to a jury trial in August, and it has since been pushed to February, at last I have heard or checked. And I am of the understanding that there will be no green lighting of anything until that situation has been resolved in one form or another.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, this is that's kind of another kind of undercurrent of this saga. I think Rob Cohen also got hit with something.
Rob Cohen there were several allegations against Rob Cohen, none of which have been proven in court. But you know, there are some uglier headlines behind this than a lot of the players would like to put forward.
Yeah, yeah. Again, just another kind of way in which this series is riding through the history
Day in Hollywood. Yeah,
you know, that's wild. Well, Barry, thanks for being on the show. And again, the name of the book is Welcome to the Family, the explosive story behind Fast and Furious, the blockbusters that supercharged the world. I will say again, I am not a Fast and Furious guy. I found it really compelling. I imagine if you are a Fast and Furious person, if you have a Fast and Furious person in your life who, you know, has need of a Christmas present coming up, I feel like this would be a very good one.
Good stocking
for them.
Stuffer.
So it'll fit right. You got to get a big stocking. You're not just putting that in a regular sock. You need a Vin Diesel size.
Dwayne Johnson size sock. Yeah.
But it's a fun one. Just for the run through the kind of changing economics of Hollywood is a really fascinating little subcurrent there for folks who are not necessarily fans of the franchise. But yeah, Barry, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Sonny.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.